18th. And I would request a overview from staff if there's anything we need to go over prior.
No, Mr. Chair. I think we'll just go through it bill by bill. And
fire away. All right. We will open a public hearing on 3632A. Is Jeff Eager?
Yes.
Hey, pretty good. Jeff Eager. Chuck, who wrote this? Chuck Burley must have written it. This is Chuck. And Scott Vadim?
Kay?
You need to go to my daughter's remedial penmanship class. Could you come forward and sign in, please?
It's a guy thing. We can't help ourselves.
Yeah. Come forward. And I will tell you, the chair has a bad cold today, so you better be humorous,
and that's
cogent,
succinct,
and
reading.
Short.
That's a one.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I want to thank you very much for having a hearing on this bill today. With me is Jeff Eager and Chuck Kenlon from the Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation, and they'll go into this in greater detail. But I just wanted to point out a couple things. One, we recognize this is a stopgap measure. This is a carve-out under existing law, and you'll hear more details about that. But we've got a larger issue to deal with, and that is, in Oregon statute, how do we define the employer-employee relationship and what's remuneration for purposes of volunteers versus employees? It's for the purpose of unemployment, workers' comp, those types of things. And you'll hear more of the details here as witnesses testify. But, Mr. Chair, I also want to thank very much the Employment Department and Boley and some of the other departments. They all worked with us on this. They were all very helpful and agreed on the goal that we were trying to get to, and we have gotten a yes on this. You'll see there's a couple little tweaks as far as some amendments, nothing of great substance. But anyways, I'll turn it over to these gentlemen. Again, I thank you for this hearing today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Burley. I just mentioned it's Jeff Eager. I'm the lawyer for Mount Bachelor and Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation. And I was the one who wrote our names on the sign-in, so the chair and the members of the committee can blame me for that.
No, this is Burley. He's not getting out of
it. And what I'd like to do for the committee is just to do my best to explain what this bill does, and then also to explain why we're looking at some very minor amendments to the bill that we're going to ask the committee to adopt when it marks up the bill. The bill deals with three separate areas of Oregon employment law. The first is the minimum wage statute, and that is dealt with in Section 1 of the bill. And we, in drafting this bill, we've worked closely with the Bureau of Labor and Industries to reach language that that does no more than protect what has traditionally been a volunteer relationship between ski volunteers and ski areas, and then also between ski volunteers and nonprofit entities that hold races at ski areas, such as Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation, and you'll hear from Chuck in just a minute. And the Section 1 simply exempts from the application of the minimum wage ski patrol services that are provided for ski areas on a volunteer basis. And in order to qualify, these folks have to be registered with the National Ski Patrol or another nonprofit entity or organization that deals in ski patrol matters. And that was language that we reached agreement on with Boley. They were very interested in getting that kind of requirement that it be there be registration with some kind of nonprofit entity, and we've reached agreement on that language. It also, Section 1 also exempts from application of the minimum wage volunteers who help Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation and other nonprofits put on races at ski areas, and Mr. Kenlon will speak more fully to the importance of that measure when he testifies. Sections 2 and 3 are mirror sections that both address workers' compensation, and this the bill simply expands an existing exemption that's already in the workers' comp statute that affects currently only ski patrol, and in this bill it would be expanded to include volunteering for races of the sort that Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation puts on. And finally, we've worked with DCBS and MLAC on that section of the bill, and they have they do not oppose it. Finally, the final two sections deal with the unemployment tax. We frankly would have liked to have had a more robust exemption from the unemployment tax in this bill. But what we ran into with the help of the Employment Department are some federal law barriers that we simply cannot get around at this time without a change to federal law. And for that reason, the sole exemption from unemployment tax in the bill is volunteers for nonprofits when the thing of value, the remuneration, is less than $50 and a quarter. That is the most that is allowed under federal law. That is currently not part of Oregon law. So this bill does include some additional protections for nonprofits, but it is not as far as we wanted to go. In summary, the bill really just narrowly targets the issues that we have, trying to protect what has uniformly been understood to be a volunteer relationship that is a traditional relationship. Ski areas have been using volunteers for a very long time in this state, as has Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation, and the bill is a good narrowly targeted measure to protect those things. And just a quick statement on the proposed amendment, it does two things. First of all, and they both apply to the minimum wage portion of the bill, which is Section 1. First of all, the current language of Section 1 says that a volunteer for a ski area, if that volunteer is registered with National Ski Patrol, capitalized, as a volunteer ski patroller, what we've done is what we seek to do with this amendment is to broaden that, because it became apparent to us that it probably wasn't a good idea to tie ourselves just to one entity that certifies and trains trains volunteer ski patrol. So what we're doing is saying National Ski Patrol or a similar nonprofit ski patrol organization. And the concern there is, what happens if National Ski Patrol goes away and it's replaced by another entity with a different name? Then we would lose the protections that are in this bill. This language doesn't increase the scope of the bill. It, for all intents and purposes, right now, it's still going to be National Ski Patrol that we're dealing with. But in the future, if there are other entities that take National Ski Patrol's place, this amendment protects the intention of the bill as passed by the House of Representatives.
Jeff, question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any mountains or ski areas in Oregon that are currently not affiliated with National Ski Patrol?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Caden might be able to answer that.
Most, I think, all of the mountains.
We need to get up on the record.
Take my seat. Okay. It's a simple answer: yes or no.
Yes, they are all affiliated. They do have some volunteer patrols that are not volunteer patrol members that are not members of the association.
And still on the same mountain. Okay. Very good.
You can just sit there if you want.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, we need his ID.
And for the record, my name is Scott Caden. I reside at 923 Oak Street, Hood River, Oregon.
And Mr. Chairman, just the second part of the amendment, we remove the term "officially sanctioned" from the nonprofit portion of Section 1, which is to say, currently the bill says that that volunteers that work on officially sanctioned races that are put on by nonprofit entities at a ski area are exempt from minimum wage. It was brought to our attention that the term "officially sanctioned" in the ski world can be interpreted to mean kind of recognized and sanctioned by an international racing body, and that is not the intent of the bill. The intent of the bill is to exempt volunteers who work at youth ski races and whatnot. These are not Olympic type races, and so taking out officially sanctioned leaves in the requirement, which we reached with Boley, that it be only races that are sponsored and organized by nonprofits, and it's only at a at an official ski area. So we've worked with Boley to get their agreement to these two. To these two additional changes from the House bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Enter and sign in, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Chuck Kenlin. I'm the executive director of the Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation in Bend, Oregon. We are a 501c3 formed in 1984. And before 1984, all the race training, ski race training, and race promotion was handled by the Mount Bachelor Ski Resort, a for-profit corporation. They realized, as many ski areas across the country, that that's a money-losing proposition to train ski racers and to put on ski races. They were involved at the time of forming 501c3, so we could have an organization that could raise money, fundraise to support these athletes and to produce ski race events that don't break the bank for families who travel here to do the ski races. Currently, we coach between 600 and 700 athletes at Mount Bachelor. The average subsidy provided to these athletes through our fundraising events is about 50%. Some of our more committed athletes, the kids that are knocking on the door of the ski team, U.S. ski team, the subsidy is closer to 70 to 80%. And those subsidies come through events that we run to raise money. The other half of what we do is part of our organization is to put on ski races at Mount Bachelor. The ski races that we run, 50% of the entry fee for a ski race goes to the sanctioning organizations, USSA, the Pacific Northwest Ski Association, the Western Region, as a head tax. So half of that entry fee for a race is what we get to take to cover our expenses for putting on the race. We use a lot of volunteers to help us organize these races. We organize races up to national championship competitions, just down to our own club, inter-club races for our youth skiers. If our volunteers were to be determined employees, and we were subject to having to pay minimum wage and pay the workman's comp on them, our entry fees would go from about $34 near $80 to cover the expense. And a couple things would happen. Number one, it wouldn't be within our mission to do that, to charge that much to kids. And the other thing is we would never get a bid on a ski race, and they would quit coming to Mount Bachelor. Currently, if we were to look at last season's race calendar, about 2,200 visitor days in Central Oregon. Based on COVA, the Central Oregon Visitors Association's amount that they say an average visitor spends in Central Oregon during the wintertime, that's about close to $1.4 million economic impact in Central Oregon from the races that we produce. Right now, we've got a seven-day event going on up at Mount Bachelor that we're running, about 210 athletes, and most of those athletes in this event come with a family, and they're spending a whole week in Bend. They're spending money on food, hotels, lift tickets at Mount Bachelor, entertainment. If this happened, those things would go away. And again, that would be it wouldn't fit within our mission. Our mission is to make the sports affordable to our athletes. If we no longer put on ski races, or the other Oregon clubs such as ours weren't allowed to put on ski races, they would be traveling out of state, spending their money out of state. Our athletes would have to spend quite a bit more to travel to those races. So it's really important to our organization to have the ability to put on affordable ski races at Mount Bachelor. And I don't know if many of you know the history of this. What happened was one of our race volunteers, in filling out an unemployment claim, when was asked to list all her different jobs, she listed the value of her ski pass as income, and that's what triggered this. Again, as Jeff stated, the employment department has been really good for us to work with. They've been flexible. They've made it easy for us to do this. And respectfully, I would like you to consider this and pass this out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Yes.
Close answer.
Thank you. Maybe, Jeff, I think you're the one that said this. Under the federal remuneration is limited to $50 per quarter. So that triggered something to me, because I'm assuming these ski passes cost more than $50, what would be assessed as a quarter. How much are the ski passes that valued at?
The passes in question are at $479.
And then the ski season is more than one quarter?
Yes.
Two quarters. So is that breaking that up? I'm just trying to figure out where we're going to be doing something here in the state that may be against federal regulations. If they're limiting you to $50 per quarter, does that really resolve the problem?
Well, Senator, I don't think that we believe that it's going to solve the problem for a full season pass provided by MBSEF to its volunteers. And in that way, it is not an ideal solution to us. But nor does the bill sanction that activity. So I don't think by enacting this law, and we've worked very closely with the Employment Department to make sure that we're not getting sideways with federal law with this, there's nothing about this statute that says that MBSEF giving a full season pass to its volunteers is okay. It simply is what it says, which is anything, if you're giving volunteers $50 or less a quarter in remuneration, then you're not subject to the unemployment tax. There are some instances where MBSEF provides single day passes to its volunteers, and there may be some situations in which that only happens once a quarter, and perhaps then MBSEF receives some protection from this law. But where MBSEF does certainly receive protection in this law is in workers' compensation and minimum wage, which are which have triggering statutes that are very similar to the unemployment tax. And the concern is that because a court has now ruled that MBSEF is subject to the unemployment tax, that for the same reasons it could be subject to workers' compensation and minimum wage. So the bill, while not providing ideal protection on unemployment tax, does provide good protection on the other employment regulations that would allow MBSEF to continue its volunteer raise program.
Mr. Chair, if I can. So I just want to clarify regarding the minimum wage part. Are you saying, or do you believe, that the agencies would then turn around and say, because of the type of compensation they're receiving and based on this ruling that's been handed down by the court, that these volunteers are no longer volunteers but are in fact employees?
Under current law, Senator? Yes, that is the concern.
Stopgap. That was another issue that was raised at the very beginning, that this was a stopgap. What are we going to next after the stopgap?
Well, I think you brought up a very good point about the limitations per quarter, and I think the ski industry is going to work with Oregon's congressional delegation to see if we can adjust those. My understanding is that those limits were set in place in 1972, and they might be time for review. So after the proceedings here at the state level, we will be approaching the congressional delegation to see if we can work on that issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may. Non-professional ski patrollers, that's what's in our summary. That's what I'm assuming we classify these individuals. Do we actually have professional ski patrollers?
Yes, we do.
What's the difference between the two, except
The professional patrol are paid, and they are employees of the ski areas generally.
What's the function and duties? I mean, this is concerning to me because I think we're setting up what's going to be a dual track, and we're just going to identify somebody as a volunteer when someone else is saying, no, they really are professional and they are an employee. So I'm trying to figure out what the distinctions are.
I'll speak in generalities, but in general, a pro patroller requires a higher level of training and has a very distinct set of duties at a ski area. For example, a pro patrol would be in charge of avalanche control. You would not see that with a volunteer patrol. So they do overlap duties on the mountain, but the pro patrol handles the more technical aspects of patrolling at the ski areas, and they're compensated for that knowledge and training that they've received.
Okay. One other question.
Maybe if I could also explain, not all mountains have pro patrols. Generally, the pro patrollers are associated with the larger, more complex operations like a Mount Bachelor. You wouldn't see pro patrols at the Warner Canyons, at the Spout Springs, at the Anthony Lakes. Those patrols are generally 100% volunteer.
Okay. And then I guess seeing this as kind of a carve-out for ski areas, aren't we looking at a bigger issue statewide for volunteers in any type of organization? And if so, what are we looking at addressing, if anything? I mean, my concern, this is almost like a special legislation exclusively for one entity or one organization. And if we're getting these type of rulings as to questioning volunteer status as being volunteers versus employees, I wonder if we've had any, let's say, broader discussions as to how that may impact other disciplines within the state that use volunteers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, if I could back up and take the other question as well. Scott, I think, did a good job answering the difference between pro and volunteer, but, you know, I was a member of the National Ski Patrol for 12 years and volunteered at Mount Bachelor, and, you know, I've got a whole other career. I mean, I do that because I enjoy the sport and the public service and helping people. I also did it because I wanted to get the medical training because I traveled throughout Eastern Oregon for my job. And I just wanted to be able to handle an instance if it came up in the woods or on the highway or whatever the case was. So it's definitely a two-track thing. I mean, those that choose to become professional patrollers, as Scott said, a lot of them are paramedics. They go to very extensive training on avalanche control and other things that we as volunteer patrollers don't. And though we work together, if you've got a, you know, bad trauma case on the mountain, for example, you're going to have a pro patroller there with you because they've got the paramedic skills, and our emergency medical skills are not quite as high. Relative to the other question, the carve-out, the existing statute right now, the Oregon Revised Statutes, already has quite a few carve-outs, and I don't know if the Employment Department's planning on testifying today, but they do have, they did provide us a list when they testified in the House Committee on this. And, you know, these carve-outs include things like rodeo queens, for example. When you know, a young lady becomes selected as rodeo queen for the roundup, they're given travel and gifts over the course of the year. And so they, you know, whatever year that was, decided to exempt that from these portions of the statute. So it's not now without precedent. But the bigger question is, as you pointed out, and ever since this October appeals court decision came out, there's been a lot of people contacting me, as they may have been you as well, saying, what are we going to do about this? Because it includes our Community College Foundation that uses volunteers, the Battery and Rape Alliance in Deschutes County. I mean, all these folks have contacted me saying, what does this mean for us? And so what I hope to do between now and then is work with the departments and others that are interested and see if we can come up with something for 2009 to deal with this on a more general basis statewide.
Okay. So if I could just summarize, Mr. Chair. So what I'm understanding, understand the carve-out and why we're doing it. At this point, if we move this bill forward, then the nonprofit foundation is going to be potentially on the hook if it continues to give a full season pass to their volunteers under federal rules. Is that correct? In
yes,
other words,
Senator.
If they don't drop it back to limiting
yes,
it to $50
Senator.
Per
they,
quarter.
They, the bill does not provide them with any protection in that situation beyond what they have currently.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Let me interrupt you.
Okay.
If anyone in the audience is not familiar with National Ski Patrol and volunteers are associated with them, what these individuals do is really quite impressive. And I suppose at this juncture I should declare a conflict of interest since my wife is on the volunteer patrol. For this $475 pass, they spend more money than that in gas getting to the mountain. And this isn't lollygagging down the slopes, oh, what a pretty day. These folks are working 8, 10, 12 hours a day sometimes. Very disruptive to their personal lives. They're just not there joyriding and enjoying the mountain. They're there so other people can joyride and enjoy the mountain. It's really a wonderful organization.
That fits very well with my question. $479 pass as compared to a professional ski patrol person who's going to be making how much?
Do you have any ideas?
Boy, I wouldn't want to venture a guess, but I mean it's substantial compensation.
Okay. We're probably talking what a couple thousand bucks a month because they're going to get the pass and they're going to get wages and benefits. And
I think that's a pretty good estimate. Yeah.
Any other questions? Floyd, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I see. No one else. Comment, Jackie?
No, I just said if there's no one else, I think we're ready to.
We're ready to go. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3632A and open a work session on House Bill 3632A with regard, and I think the individuals describe the amendment well. All they're doing is inserting, another language, a clarification language. So if there's...
If you're looking for a motion,
I am.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 3632.
Jackie Winters has moved the -2s into 3632. Any discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move...
Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3632 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Winters. Any further discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, it's 3632A.
Yes, 3632A.
I think I said that the first time. Any objections to moving 3632A as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendations?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and vote aye on the getting it out of committee to the floor, but I'm reserving that I may change my vote. I'm looking at how this came out of the House. Looks like there was maybe a lot of confusion over there, or maybe I didn't catch something that they caught, and so may change my vote on the floor.
We appreciate you helping it get there. Let the record show there are no objections, and House Bill 3632A, as amended by this committee, will move to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Cruz will be carrying the bill.
I'll carry this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, before we next bill, can we be at ease so we can bring in one of the witnesses to on the telephone?
Yes.
Okay. Can drop the mics.
Okay, we will reconvene the Senate Committee on Commerce and Labor, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3630A. Any comments from staff?
Oh, Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3630 was a bill that we saw in concept form during the interim. We had a number of hearings on this. This is a bill that's coming to you from the Mortgage Lending Work Group. The measure passed unanimously out of the House Consumer Protection Committee as well as the House floor. You have in front of you a -A3 amendment that comes from the work group that has technical amendments. And in your packet, you also have my attempt at a hand-engrossed amendment to show you the changes in the measure.
Very good. So with that, let's get right to it. And what's that?
Instead of we'll have Corey come up. Sorry.
All right, with that, let's get right to it. Our first panel will be Representative Suzanne Bonamici, Corey Streisinger, and on the phone, Chris Ambrose.
If we could have Lou Savage come up also, we would appreciate it.
Who wants to go first?
Corey? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger.
May I stop you just a second? Chris, can you hear Corey all right?
I can hear you. Thank you, Senator.
Very good.
Thank you. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of House Bill 3630. This is one of a number of bills which you have spent time on this session dealing with the general subject of mortgages, and it does represent one of two bills that came out of the governor's work group looking at this issue. The other bill, Senate Bill 1064, has already passed out of this committee and is going to be heard in ways and means, we hope, this afternoon. We've spent a fair amount of time talking about the situation that Oregon faces today, and I'm not going to go through it again in detail. Suffice it to say that we are seeing an increase in foreclosures in Oregon, not to the same extent as elsewhere in the country, but still some troubling numbers and ones that we think are cause for concern. If you take a look at some of the statistics, which I've included in my testimony, and there is a sheet of statistics that looks like this attached to the testimony, what we see is foreclosure rates increasing in Oregon, particularly with respect to subprime and adjustable rate mortgages and what are called option ARM mortgages. With respect to those mortgages in particular, about 7% of Oregon borrowers with subprime adjustable rate mortgages were at least 90 days past due as of the third quarter of 2007. So those people are at risk of foreclosure. We have approximately 88,000 outstanding subprime mortgages in Oregon today, and it's estimated that we face about 12,000 foreclosures over the next couple of years. So those people facing foreclosure are definitely of concern to us, and that's what the subject of this bill. The bill attempts to provide protection for people facing foreclosure in a couple of different ways. One of them is that the bill addresses people who approach those facing foreclosure with offers that may sound good, offers to get them out of foreclosure, offers to help. Sometimes those offers are legitimate. Sometimes they are not. Very often they are confusing. So the bill puts regulations in place dealing with both those who are foreclosure consultants as well as those who actually take equity then in your property, sometimes with a promise to sell it back to you or to lease it back to you, a promise which sometimes turns out not to be one that is realistic under the circumstances. And the bill also then addresses the topic of better notice to those facing foreclosure. Often someone facing foreclosure does have options. There are counseling services available to assist Many lenders have workout programs or forbearance programs, particularly in today's market, where lenders do not want to take homes back into foreclosure and are willing to renegotiate terms. But in order to take advantage of those programs, the borrower needs to know that they exist and needs to know who to contact. So the bill includes a plain language notice providing that information to them. I have also included in my materials some of the existing foreclosure prevention counseling services which exist in Oregon today. There's a list of them, and the list is growing. They're also posted on our website. If you have constituents who are in need of that information, we would certainly encourage you to steer them this direction, and the notice that is required under this bill will also contain a single point of contact to get that information. A number of different states have looked at what to do to help their citizens facing foreclosure. And also finally attached to my materials is a summary, an executive summary of what other states are doing, put out by the National Council on State Legislatures. If you look through that list, you will see a lot that looks familiar and a lot that is in fact included in House Bill 3630. We have not proposed a bailout type of scheme, but we have proposed a series of ways that people facing foreclosure can get help. So with that general overview, other members of the panel are going to go into the bill in somewhat more detail, and then, of course, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Corey, the minor changes in the dash A3s, you're okay with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, absolutely. We recommend the dash A3s, and again, I think others are going to go through them in more detail. But this work group, and I have attached a list of the work group members also, has put in hours of work going through the details, and as is always the case, there are, as you move forward, people come up with additional issues or fixes that avoid unintended consequences, and that's what the dash A3s represent.
Suzanne, do you want to go next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Suzanne Bonamici. I am the Vice Chair of the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and I also serve on the Governor's Work Group on Mortgage Lending. I'm here in support of House Bill 3630A. One of the things to keep in mind as you're reviewing this bill is that people facing foreclosure are often the vulnerable in our communities, and they're very desperate to save their homes. They're acting under a sense of urgency to try to make sure that they can keep their homes and the equity in their homes. That's why we call this the Mortgage Rescue Fraud Protection Act. The first two parts of the bill, actually up to Section 19, address the foreclosure consultants and equity purchasers, and then the third section from Section 19 forward is the to require the clear, plain language foreclosure notice that Director Streisinger mentioned. So Sections 2 through 8 deal with the practices of foreclosure consultants, and in general they're defined as people who make solicitations or representations to people about preventing or stopping foreclosure sales. I did a little search on Craigslist and found some very interesting definitions and advertisements of people who were advertising their services of foreclosure consultants. They offer to save the home. There was one that said, "We use unconventional methods to help you save your home." But you really wonder what they're getting when borrowers deal with those companies. So we have the definition of foreclosure consultant as someone who is compensated from the homeowner. And the reason we added that language, I want to explain for the record, is because we were concerned about legitimate investors, and we want to make sure that we don't stop people who are helping by buying homes. But once they cross over from that arm's length transaction into this counseling, that's when we intend for them to be covered. We're hoping that the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Department of Justice will be watching this carefully to make sure that we've drawn the appropriate line as this bill hopefully is implemented. There are some exclusions in who is a foreclosure consultant, and we did that in recognition of, for example, realtors and mortgage brokers and lenders who are in the process of trying to refinance. We didn't want them, as long as they are acting in the scope of their license, to be covered by these provisions. but they do need to be acting within the scope of their license. The same is true with attorneys. There's also a limited exemption for tax-exempt organizations that are in the business of providing housing counseling for at least 5 years. And we put the five-year requirement in to make sure that foreclosure consultants didn't go out and all of a sudden become nonprofits to evade the requirements of the bill. The primary requirements and prohibitions you'll find in sections 4 through 6, there's a written contract that's required. The homeowner needs to get that contract 24 hours in advance so they have time to review it. It needs to be in plain language, which you can see on pages 3 and 4 of the engrossed bill. And also, for a foreclosure consulting contract, the homeowner can cancel at any time. If they do cancel, they need to pay back within 60 days. They need to pay back any money that the foreclosure consultant has advanced on their behalf, but they do have that right to cancel. And the contract also needs to contain the cancellation instructions and a detachable notice of cancellation. So violation of this particular section is there's enforcement by the Attorney General, and this is also going to become an unlawful trade practice under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, so the consumer will have a right of action if the consumer can show an ascertainable loss and willful conduct. So then sections 9 through 18 deal with the second part of foreclosure consulting, which we have titled as equity conveyances. Some states use different languages, but basically this is the type of foreclosure rescue transaction that involves the equity purchaser actually taking an interest in the property. These often involve a sale leaseback. And we heard a story in our Consumer Protection Committee on the House side from a Mr. Knox who came in and told, he's a senior citizen who was stuck in a subprime mortgage and ended up facing foreclosure after he had to pay medical bills and his wife had passed away and was really facing some hard times. He ended up in one of these sale leaseback transactions. Really heart-wrenching story, and the consequences of these can be quite devastating. So these require, because of the possibility of actually losing the home, these require, again, the written contract 24 hours in advance. This one needs to be notarized when it's signed. There's some very strict guidelines that need to be followed. For example, with a sale leaseback, they need to make sure that there's a reasonable ability to repay so that they know that they're not just getting into further financial difficulties. And importantly, the exemption in this section are very limited and include only a party to a deed in lieu of foreclosure, certain entities under the jurisdiction of a bankruptcy court, and a family or living trust. So any of the other entities, realtors, attorneys, mortgage brokers, bankers, anybody who wants to do this type of transaction has to go through the steps that we set forth in sections 9 through 18. Again, the plain language notice makes very clear that the homeowner is transferring the deed or title and could result in the permanent loss of the home. There are only 3 days to cancel this particular type of transaction, and that has to do with the fact that these transactions are recorded. The 3 days right to cancel is analogous to the right to cancel in a home equity loan. But we did require the recording of a memorandum of the sale leaseback agreement. And the reason we did that is because if the equity purchaser goes out and tries to further encumber the property or tries to sell the property while the homeowner still has a right, we want to make sure that that memorandum is on record so that any potential purchaser will have notice and therefore not be a bona fide purchaser. So those are the provisions dealing with the equity purchase. And again, because this is a more serious potential for risk, we allowed a private right of action that's outside of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which has a short statute of limitations, and instead used the contract statute of limitations of 6 years. So the homeowner has a longer time to bring an action for a violation of the equity conveyance portion. One thing I just want to note, Section 15 is a is short but important provision, and that for some of you who may be interested in this, just to put on the record, preserves the legal doctrine of equitable mortgage, and that is a theory that courts can impose when they look at a transaction, and even if the paperwork looks like a sale and leaseback, if the indicia are there that it was really more of a intent to be a mortgage transaction, the court will actually impose that doctrine of equitable mortgage. We wanted to make clear that nothing in this statute precludes that. Again, there's enforcement of this section by the Attorney General and that private right of action. And finally, the third section of the bill dealing with a notice of foreclosure. This new notice, and Director Streisinger explained this, this notice is going to be on the top of the stack of papers that people get when they get a notice of foreclosure. We heard testimony that almost half, at least half, of the borrowers who face foreclosure don't even make a phone call. They don't know what to do. They don't know who to call. The documents that they currently receive are very technical, full of legalese. This is a plain language notice that provides them with helpful information about the amount that is due, who they can call. It acts essentially as a hotline. In other states that have foreclosure hotlines, I've seen a lot of success in getting the homeowners in touch with someone who can provide helpful information, legitimate information that will help them when they face foreclosure. There'll be a notice here for the Oregon State Bar's Lawyer Referral Service, and that hopefully will help them with their options. So thank you so much for your attention to this. I know the Dash 3 amendments are consensus amendments. You'll notice, for example, that the change of the word attorney to lawyer in the notices is a recognition of Representative Chuck Riley's plain language bill, that we're saving a syllable there by changing attorney to lawyer. But everything we can do that will make those notices clearer for Oregonians facing foreclosure will be helpful. So thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to entertain your questions.
Let's hold questions until we hear from the remaining panelists. Chris, are you on?
I am on, Senator. Thank you.
Enter and identify yourself.
Good morning, Senator Westland, members of the committee. My name is Chris Ambrose of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association and Ambrose Law Group, and I'm here to testify and support very briefly of Senate Bill, or House Bill rather, 3630 as amended. I am primarily here, and my apologies for not being able to attend in person today. My attendance telephonically is primarily to address any questions that you may have after others have testified about the merits of the bill. As Representative Bonamici indicated, there was an extensive amount of work done on this, primarily through the task force. And when all is said and done, we believe we've reached a nice compromise, if you will, to enable homeowners to still have some assistance by legitimate foreclosure consultants and legitimate equity purchasers, while making sure that there's some regulation in place so that they're not taken advantage of. They are particularly vulnerable, as you might imagine, during this foreclosure process. The intent is not to preclude, again, legitimate purchaser from coming forward and helping these people out, but limiting to some extent, and quite frankly to a great extent, those individuals who are going to come forward and try and enter into arrangements that are going to take advantage of those who are particularly vulnerable during the foreclosure process. So with that, I certainly will just turn it over and make myself available for any questions and would be happy to remain on the line. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions for this set
of... Mr. Chair, I think Lou...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, would you like to take a look at the amendments in more detail? We're certainly able to...
You know, I think so. Just a very brief overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I wanted also to echo Corey's recognition of the work group. A tremendous amount of effort was put in on this, including, Mr. Chair, your work, as well as Representative Bonamici and Representative Holdy's attendance at all of the work group sessions and the hard work that was done to craft this legislation. With respect to the Dash 3 amendments, Representative Bonamici, I think, pointed out the first change, Teresa was very helpful in actually doing a Hammond Gross version. It makes it a little bit easier. So on page 3, the amendment inserts lawyer for the term attorney. On page 6, this is actually 6A, I guess, on the Hammond Gross version. This section actually is designed to mirror a section in the equity purchaser portion of the bill, which prohibits false and deceptive statements, so that it's clear that the foreclosure consultant is required to abide by the same terms as the equity purchaser. The next amendment is on page 12, and clarifies the charges that can be deducted from the purchase in an equity purchase situation. There was an agreement that some clarification was needed on that. The next amendment is on page 13 of the Hammond and Gross version, and it clarifies that the equity purchaser provisions do not apply to someone who is employed with regard to residential real property under the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court. And again, it's just a clarification, really a housekeeping matter. Page 14, again, we're just changing lawyer from attorney. The next amendment on page 17 of the Hammond Gross version deals with a timing issue for the equity purchase. And Chris, if you wouldn't mind addressing this provision.
Certainly, there is a presumption, and we're trying to put in a presumption so that there's a safe harbor, if you will, for the equity purchaser who wants to conduct an analysis about the ability of the homeowner to not only meet the payment requirements for the lease, but also to have a realistic ability to repurchase the property prior to expiration of the lease option period of time, because there are significant consequences in favor of the homeowner if they're able to exercise their option, and if they're not, the amount of net proceeds that they're going to be receiving at the end. And so on the other hand, we wanted to make sure that a purchaser, again, has some kind of safe harbor so that they're operating within within some parameters, not leaving it open to speculation about whether they're doing the right thing or not, or whether or not the terms that they're entering into are reasonable. So the amendments on page 17 and 18 dealing with reasonable ability to pay and the timing of the equity conveyance contract are intended to clarify that there's a presumption of the 60% presumption that is going to be calculated at the time that the equity purchaser and the homeowner enter into the contract, so that, again, there's no speculation at the end of the line about whether or not this was a reasonable contract or not.
Thanks, Chris. The next amendment is on page 20, section 20. It clarifies that the notice of default should be sent both by certified and first-class mail. The Hammond Gross amendment on page 22 is a recognition that the proper term under the notice provision, the new notice provision, should be beneficiary and not grantee. This was something that one of the Oregon State Bar sections pointed out to us. And finally, on line 18 of page 22, We're clarifying that it should be both first class and certified mail for the notice that's required under this section.
Great.
Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for this panel?
Here. Just to make sure, I'm looking at the bullet points on the handout by Corey. And it says requires the equity purchaser, if the property is resold within 24 months of the equity purchase, 82% will go to the homeowner. Is that going to discourage anyone from moving forward as an equity purchaser?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, maybe Chris could address the 82% threshold.
Yes, Senator, and thank you, Director. The 82% threshold is a number that has been developed over the last couple of years by a number of other states, along with an entity or an organization known as the Center for Policy Initiatives, located back east in Maryland, I believe. And it essentially was somewhat of a compromise provision that is deemed as being a number that equity purchasers still would be able to make a reasonable or have a reasonable return on the purchase, with, so long as there's some type of limited period of time. And the states that we've looked at ranged anywhere from 18 months to 3 years. The task force ended up with a two-year period of time, which is somewhat equivalent to the average lease option period of time. So a long-winded way of saying that when all is said and done, an equity purchaser who's really in this to make a substantially more than the rate of return that's set forth in this legislation simply has to wait the two-year period of time, which most of the task force believe was a reasonable period of time to wait.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Before Suzanne gets away, well, there are many of us in this room that worked very hard on the work group. I mean, the department, individuals, if I start naming names, we'll be here for another 20 minutes. But I did in particular want to recognize Representative Bonamici's and Chris Ambrose's work on this work group. It was really exemplary, and we all appreciate your efforts. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Chris, did you want to stay on the line or to listen to the hearing?
Yeah. Certainly, I'd be happy to stay
okay.
on the line.
Okay, it's your choice.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, next panel, Matt Jaffe, Liz Carruthers, and Sybil Hebb. Enter and sign in, please. I guess that's incorrect. It should be speak in, please. At your convenience.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my name is Liz Carruthers. I'm a detective with Portland Police. Not here representing the city necessarily, but coming here as a detective who's been investigating real estate fraud for over the last 2 years. I don't really have an opinion on this particular bill, but I just want to point out a couple of issues that you might want to take into consideration that you might not be aware of. I sat in on one of the committee meetings while they were discussing this particular bill, and some of the problems didn't quite get ironed out. First of all, I want to ask you if you can change making this violation a criminal offense with a maximum of 1 year's imprisonment, $10,000 fine, or both. In both of the cases that I have been working that are foreclosure bailout scams, both victims are elderly. One of them is disabled. I would argue that in the vast majority of these foreclosure bailout scams, the losses to the homeowner are well over $10,000. I would argue that we should prosecute, and we are prosecuting these cases as aggravated theft in the first degree. It's a B felony. Don't weaken this for me. I'd much rather have a B felony than this. So that's just something to take into consideration. And it's easy to prove that the loss is over $10,000 because frequently what happens in the course of these transactions is the purchaser frequently is taking out a loan and stripping the equity at the same time as they are bailing the person out of foreclosure. So simultaneously, there is very frequently an appraisal that is done simultaneous to closing, and the appraisal then states the value of the home, and that's how you're able to prove that the person is actually stripping over $10,000 out of the home in equity. So I would argue that it really should stay aggravated theft in the first degree, and or make the punishments mirror the criminal statutes. Rather than creating a separate violation that's less than what it really could be.
Mr. Chair, where are we at in the bill? I'm just trying to, I need to know where you're referring to in the bill so I can read the
punishment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski. I haven't had time to read the whole bill. I got called down here at the last minute's notice, so I'm only looking at the summary.
Okay.
Page which?
20.
And then let me, if I could, Mr. Chair, let you know there's another bill that's on its way, hopefully out of this building, SB 1087, which does deal with aggravated theft from an elderly person. But I don't know if the criteria that's in that bill would actually fit for this situation regarding houses, but we'll look at it.
Okay. The other thing I was going to let you know is, in dealing with these cases, I have spoken directly to lenders, not mortgage brokers, not the loan originators, but the lenders themselves involved in these transactions, and this one in particular. The leaseback option being notarized, is there a provision in here where it must be disclosed to the lender? Because if it is, the lender most likely will not approve the loan for this house if the buyer is taking out a loan. In this particular case, I spoke with City Residential, which used to do business as Argent Mortgage, and they're huge. Their investigator specifically told me that if they had known that there was a lease option agreement, that they would never have funded the loan because it is a foreclosure bailout scam. It's textbook. So if you have this in there, you might want to think about whether it's mandatory that it gets disclosed to the lender or not. And if it is it even going to fly? And I will tell you that in almost all of these cases, almost 100% of the time, they do involve a leaseback option. Because obviously, especially for elderly people, the last thing they want to do is move out of the home that they've lived in for the last 43 years. The other thing I would like to point out that I don't know if has been mentioned or not, but in both of the cases that I have been working, the purchasers were not just people in the industry who took the fly-by-night, late-night lessons on how to buy people's homes. They were loan originators. This exempts them. And in reading this, it says that it exempts them as long as they're working in, basically in their, within their scope of duty. In both of these cases that I have had involving elderly people, I don't know if this would fall under that terminology or not, but both loan originators came onto the scene of this, of people coming into foreclosure, and offered to refinance the homes first. Obviously, people in default don't have great credit. So they were not able to refinance them. And then it becomes the special paperwork to save their house. But again, they were loan originators, and they were initially acting as loan originators when they went into the transaction.
Question.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated that currently you could prosecute those two individuals or whomever under the current statutes, but you would not be able to prosecute under the proposal in this one. Is that correct?
No. What I meant to say, and I'm sorry, Senator Winters, Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is that I think that the applicable statute is already on the books for prosecuting these cases, okay, and that you'd be adding one that is weaker than the one that you already have on the books by adding this criminal sanction to this ORS.
Mr. Chair, I have staff from Judiciary bringing the bill down. I agree, based on what I read here, what we could be setting up is a subsection or a subcomponent that says this particular type of theft would be a misdemeanor, as anything else that would be over $10,000 would be a felony. So we're going to pull the bill and look at it and make sure we're not working at cross purposes.
And good. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Very much.
You're welcome.
Don't go away.
Chair Westland, members of the committee. My name is Matt Jaffe. I'm here representing the city of Portland. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3630A. We'd like to thank the committee and the governor's work group for the many, many hours that have gone into these series of bills. I would, however, like to draw your attention to Section 3, Subsection 2 of the Angros bill.
What page?
It's on the second page. All right, it's on the bottom of the second page.
Okay.
And this section identifies who is not considered a foreclosure consultant. And I was just come before you today to ask for clarification on the record that it is the committee's understanding and intent that cities and other local governments are included in the definition of a person and are not considered foreclosure consultants for the purposes of this bill.
What line are you on, Matt?
I am on
page 2,
line 31. Page 2, line 31.
You know, I don't think so, but I'm not an attorney, so we'll ask a lawyer.
I'm sorry, I've been buried in the book, so I need to know where we're at.
We're on page 2, section 3, line 31.
And the question is?
The question is, for the purposes of this bill, whether cities are considered a person. We know that for the intents, cities do hold liens. The city of Portland, to my understanding, in talking with folks in our attorney's office, has not ever gone through the foreclosure process, but does hold liens. Just want to clarify that it is not the intent that cities are considered foreclosure consultants for the purposes of this bill.
Mr. Chair, we do have legislative counsel here in the room as well.
Excellent.
If you want to choose to bring him forward.
Where is he?
In the back corner.
Oh, totally hiding. Yeah.
He's trying to get behind the curtain over there. Come on, Chuck.
If you could come forward, please, and perhaps, Liz, can you vacate your seat? Are you?
Representative Paul Amici may also be able to help us with this, too. Origin. Which one?
This is not our intent, so.
Yes.
But we've all dealt with, sometimes over multiple sessions,
certainly
small issues. Everyone knew what we were talking about, but that's
certainly
not exactly what was.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
Just for sake of clarification, what the question is that in Section 3 is listing the exclusions from who is considered a foreclosure consultant, and on 31 there's an exclusion for a person who holds or is owed an obligation that's secured by a lien or et cetera. And the question would be, is the city
for the purpose of this bill, is the city considered a person?
Right. So that's the underlying
yes.
question.
That's the question.
Good morning, members. Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. Mr. Savage was just pointing out that in the bill, in order to be a foreclosure consultant, first of all, you have to be getting compensated for your services. Mm-hmm. Beyond that point, the definition of person is controlled by ORS 174.100, which is a definition that applies throughout all of Oregon revised statutes. Person includes individuals, corporations, associations, firms, partnerships, limited liability companies, and joint stock companies. So that those are the entities that would be covered by the term person.
Alderman,
the
if I can just follow up, mm-hmm. Chuck, I see that as the general definition, but we know under the words and phrases, person throughout the statutes may have a peculiar or unique definition. Is there any concern that maybe it's been defined some other way or some other place in the statutes that would be applicable to this particular area of law?
Chair Westland, Senator Prosansky, I'm not aware of any okay. other definition that would apply.
Thank you.
Question?
So, clarification, Mr. Chairman. Does that, and the only thing I listed in there that was close to being a municipal corporation is a nonprofit entity, but and the other issue is we're not under the other definition, you're not receiving compensation, but the compensation under that other definition, I believe, is from the actual owner of the home, which in this case you would not. So if you're not covered by the person, you'd be covered from by the other section where you're not receiving compensation.
Chair Westland, Senator Devlin, the other thing, too, is to look at what the foreclosure consultant is doing, and that is that he is making some type of a representation that he is going to prevent the home from being foreclosed on, and I don't think that government, as far as having any type of a tax lien or anything like that, is representing that their taxation of the property is somehow going to prevent it being foreclosed upon.
You know, let us stand in recess for just a moment. Reconvene. We will reconvene the committee, and I think what we're going to do is hold this bill over until Wednesday so all parties can get together I am concerned about the penalty provisions, but if we do that, maybe we're raising the bar for other types of fraudulent proof of conviction. So this is, as always, never-ending and ever-complicated. That's what we're going to do, but I think we're going to have a couple comments from panelists first.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify for the record, it is the chair's intent to still move the bill on Wednesday. We're just trying to make sure that we've got every I dotted and every T crossed, or at least to the best of our ability by Wednesday.
No, that, excuse me for failing to say that. No, I still think there's incredibly broad consensus around this bill. Our obligation is to get it as good as we possibly can before it hits the governor's desk. So,
Mr. Chair, I did have staff from Judiciary bring me the 1087, which is the referral that hopefully will be coming out of our legislature to the people regarding repeat property offenders. And for the detective, the section I was referring to regarding aggravated theft, it says when a person is convicted of aggravated theft in the first degree, the court shall impose a penalty for a person incarcerated from a range of 16 to 45 months, depending on their criminal history, if the victim of the theft was 65 years or older at the time of the commission of the offense, and then a couple more things. So this will be a subset of those who are committing aggravated theft. If they fit the criteria, let's say in this case the victim was 65 or older, we'd actually have a penalty of somewhere between 16 and 45 months, which would definitely accommodate what you would like, maybe a little bit more. But then we would still retain the standard sentencing guidelines on theft and aggravated theft in the first degree. So then I would say, based on what we have in front of us here, Mr. Chair, regarding House Bill 3630, Section 18 is, let's say, running contrary to what I think most of us would want to see done, and we would, in fact, want to see that as a treated as a felony, not a misdemeanor, and probably leave it within the framework of the aggravated theft in the first degree.
Mr. Chair, I'm just down here nodding my head.
I can sense it. Senator Winters.
And I was just agreeing with my colleague that we need to have the penalty, make certain that we're not in conflict with the penalty. I was just having a sidebar conversation with the detective of knowing of one of the cases that my office is dealing with. We don't want to lessen the penalty for this particular crime. If anything, we want to increase it. Some of us are chronologically advantaged on this podium.
I have conferred with the good Senate Majority Leader, and he feels that should we hold this over till Wednesday, we have enough time, just barely enough time, to get it voted on in the Senate and concurred in on the House floor.
Mr. Chairman, but clarification in that we have enough time if the House concurs.
We do have. That's what I was saying. For the House to concur.
And nothing but concur.
But looking at the vote count coming out, it looked pretty strong to begin with. So I don't think we have too many worries there. And I just want to point something out. This isn't said often enough. But what you and the audience are all witnessing, and what many of you hopefully at home on your TVs are witnessing, is the strength of the committee process. Mm-hmm. These hearings are designed to do exactly what has occurred here today. This is not a pejorative comment on anyone that has worked this bill. Quite the contrary. We've got it this close and gotten it this far, but committees are really the most important public policy entity that Oregon citizens have going for them. So this is actually very good. I am not frustrated in any way. What we're seeing is how the process is supposed to work. It's very affirming to me.
Mr. Chair, I know you said it, but I think a thank you again to Detective Liz Crothers for coming today to testify, because had she not, We may or may not have found this piece that needed to be corrected, and I, again, I just want to thank you because it's very important.
Thank you, Liz. And good to see you. All right. Any other comments? Anything good of the order? We are adjourned.
Good work.